Good morning. My name is Michael McCusker. To begin today's program, I owe a humbled mea culpa for last week's misplacement of the 228th anniversary of America's Bill of Rights to its Constitution at the day before the winter solstice, instead of its true site at the Ides of December. I noticed my error of alternate fact with a slap to the brain pan 2 days later when I glanced at my script on Friday the 13th, a baneful cup of moth and rust, as they said in the old days. I made a nearly identical error the previous week at the close of a program eulogizing Walt Disney and Pearl Harbor anniversaries. I wished everybody a happy Bill of Rights Day on December 10th, which actually was the 71st birthday of the United Nations Universal Declaration of Human Rights. Bite my tongue. I called KMUN the instant I recognized my stupid mistake, and the amputation occurred prior to broadcast, which temporarily preserved my elderly id. So I think I should also apologize for neglecting to mention Eleanor Roosevelt as the ramrod behind the UN Declaration of Human Rights. Mrs. Roosevelt made a cogent and critically prophetic remark when she said nearly a century ago, "Women should get into the political game and stay in it." An excellent reason women should be in politics is that women generally represent more generous and humane prospects for humanity. Women are literally pregnant with our future and provide the compassion and Gaia wisdom of our species. All issues are women's issues, Geraldine Ferraro insisted as the first woman candidate for vice president of the USA of either major party in 1980. The best example a woman ought to be elected president in 2020 is the current and deservedly impeached Donald J. for Judas Trump. The truth is, it is women in particular who know Trump for the vile worm he truly is. And it is primarily on their account, from the mass of women's anti-Trump marches at the start of his presidency to the 2018 election of women to Congress, that he is being impeached. "We may be led, but we will never be driven," one of the founding mothers declared during the revolution. One date I believe I do have correct might be a parallel coincidence to yesterday's vote of impeachment by the House of Representatives. That same date of December 18th, 398 years ago in 1621, the English House of Commons sent a missive to King James I of Bible fame that the House of Commons, a rough equivalent to our own House of Reps, had, quote, full right to deal with and decide on matters of king and state without, again, a quote, punishment. King James responded by tearing up the protest note and promptly disbanded Parliament, which Donald Trump wishes he had such power, a right he implicitly claims as though he were America's God-King, and which impeachment of him is all about. And now, two perennials I repeat now and again, particularly near the date of humanity's first successful powered flight 116 years ago, plus 2 days, on December 17, 1903. The Wright brothers, Wilbur and Orville, two mechanically ingenious bicycle builders, invented powered flight. Only 66 years later, two human spacemen walked on the moon, which winked with a rocket in its eye. And so this is something I wrote, and therefore the disclaimer that it's my responsibility and my opinion only, perhaps in all the universes and cosmos. 30 seconds over Armageddon starts with a quote with Mark Twain. "We shan't have to leave our fortress now when we want to blow up civilization." And by I.A.R. Wiley. Planes were invented by the Wright brothers some years ago, and when not engaged in killing people, are wont to take them from one place to another. Without the presence of insects or birds, humanity might not have thought of flying through the air, though perhaps even without these, the simple act of falling to the ground could well have been inspiration for flight. The first attempts to swim through the sky imitated birds. Blotchy old films of some of these tries, men jumping from cliffs, flapping artificial wings attached to their arms or backs, strange homemade contraptions that usually crashed, seem funny now, but recorded real tragedy in visually eloquent pain, sometimes death, and failed or misapplied concept of aerodynamics. By the time Wilbur and Orville Wright successfully flew the first engine-powered airplane, 116 years ago Tuesday, December 17, 1903, the striving to attain free flight above the Earth had developed balloons and gliders. Practical gas engines designed by Benz and Daimler provided the motive breakthrough. At Kitty Hawk, North Carolina, December 17, 1903, the Wright brothers flew the world's first true airplane, which they named simply Flyer. Orville Wright piloted the motorized glider a few feet over sand dunes on a windswept beach and raised human beings on wings of their own. Those wings have developed more rapidly in the past century than any other human invention. Supersonic jets, space rockets, and intercontinental nuclear missiles are far removed from the generation of flying machines spawned by the Wright brothers' success. Within only a few years, warplanes were hurtling into the skies. Powered flight developed in many directions, but it has been as an agent of warfare that has made the past century and more the bloodiest battleground in history. The bomber, in particular, has accounted for the slaughter of more victims than a hundredfold of previous eras. Francesco Lana di Terzi wrote in 1670 his visions of fleets of aerial machines that could fly over cities and drop vast numbers of missiles down upon defenseless citizens below. On October 23, 1911, the first bombs were dropped from such machines over Tripoli during the Italo-Turkish War. The Turks protested the war crime of a hospital bombed. Aerial bombardment developed in World War I from reconnaissance flying. If an enemy could be seen, he might as well be bombed. Strategic bombing, or the psychological destruction of civilian fortitude, came afterward, first with the great German Zeppelin raids on London. For most of the war, the belligerents concentrated primarily on tactical bombing, which meant of each other's soldiers. The first long-range heavy bomber raids were made by the French in 1915 against German cities. Later that year, London suffered its first Zeppelin raids, which were followed by attacks by large bomber formations when Britain's air defenses outmatched the huge dirigibles. In turn, British bombers retaliated against Germany. The Italians made the only truly strategic raids during World War I, massing large numbers of aircraft to attack a single target, such as the Austro-Hungarian city of Pola on October 22, 1918, the last major air raid of the war. The other warring nations haphazardly bombed each other for revenge and to raise morale in their respective homelands. World War I bombers were crude and clumsy, unable to haul big enough bomb loads for real damage. Yet they killed thousands of soldiers and civilians, and more significant to the human psyche, made the very sky that envelops the Earth the most dangerous threat to existence. War movies and television documentaries have made World War II the sine qua non of air warfare. Photographs and films of huge formations of bombers flying through anti-aircraft bursts and whirling enemy fighters to drop tons upon tons of explosives on heavily populated cities. De Terzi's vision fulfilled. Europe pounded to rubble, Japan set on fire and nuked by American B-29s. The pre-World War II terror bombing of Guernica during the Spanish Civil War prompted Picasso's masterpiece, which portrayed the outcry of ordinary citizens against deliberate and indiscriminate death from the sky. The two nuclear bombs that ended World War II were carried by large human-guided machines, 3/4 of a century later, humanity has transferred its awesome arsenal of aerial devastation to primarily technological control, maintaining only a slippery hold on the trigger. The two world wars left much of the world in ruins, great cities bombed to rubble. European hegemony passed to two rival superpowers that had been allies and victors against Nazism, the United States and Communist Russia. The result was a half-century Cold War and a nuclear arms race between two conflicting and aggressive ideologies, a balance of terror defended by arguments that only nuclear parity would prevent a third world war. The U.S. and USSR spent hundreds of billions of dollars developing their nuclear arsenals, each government posing the threat of the other to continually escalate the race. Each claimed to be defending itself against the other, and the contradictory idea of a preventive war, quote-unquote, starting a war to prevent a war, was a common rationale for threatening world obliteration. The two superpowers derived their power from increasing their arsenals and making treaties that allowed for more and deadlier weapons. At the same time that the U.S. and USSR were racing through generations of nuclear weapons, both built up their conventional forces and imported weapons, troops, and military aircraft to small wars that erupted all over the globe. Each war was a threat of nuclear confrontation, yet simultaneously, these wars skirted oblivion by acting as pressure releases against the big blow. From its supposedly inviolable hemispheric fortress surrounded by oceans, the United States exported a highly sophisticated form of terror during the Cold War and after the collapse of the Soviet Union, attacking countries all over the world for one purpose or another, generally from the air with bombs and missiles. It pioneered many of the methods of war from the air and stratosphere and used bombs more than any other nation, especially on cities and small villages of other nations. With few exceptions, the USSR in Afghanistan, Israel in its wars, the United States has been the major user of bombs since World War II, which includes nuclear tests. North Korea was blasted and hundreds of thousands of Chinese soldiers napalmed during the 1950-1953. More than twice the amount of bombs dropped over Europe during World War II were used on California-sized Vietnam in the late 1960s and early 1970s. Civilians in the North converted their lives to underground underneath incessant American bombing. North Vietnamese city dwellers, like Londoners a quarter century before, evacuated their children to rural areas. After the first Persian Gulf War, the U.S. put an iron umbrella over the Middle East to guard its oil lines, striking with aircraft and missiles at targets in countries that disputed its virtual monopoly over their most lucrative regional product. The most startling use of terror from the air in the 21st century so far has been the attack on the USA by suicidal commandos who made guided missiles out of hijacked American airliners in a brilliant scheme of calculated destruction aimed at the empirical cathedrals of American civilization, the World Trade Center in New York, and the Pentagon in Washington, D.C. on September 11, 2001. The attack was the worst death toll on a single day in American history, killing more than 2,000 persons. Retaliation from the air was quick and devastating. The contradictory attitude toward the so-called war on terrorism might be illustrated by rephrasing a famous remark by Winston Churchill during World War II. "Curse those bastards who crash airplanes into our cities, and bless our heroes who arbitrarily bomb their cities." Robert E. Lee said it was probably fortunate the war was so terrible, otherwise we might grow to love it. He had not foreseen its possibilities as video entertainment, such as the two Persian Gulf Wars, provided with wire-guided missiles breaking down doors or falling through factory chimneys. A few cynics predict that future wars will be instigated against poor southern hemispheric countries to keep audience ratings high. A video Orwellian scenario from 1984 of perpetual war using high-tech air war stuff against everything above ground. The use of missiles and bombs to kill Iraqi soldiers during the first Gulf War in 1991, in particular the Turkish shoot at Iraqis fleeing from Kuwait in a massive fleet of cars, trucks, tanks evolved directly from the British use of fighters and bombers to wipe out two trapped Turkish divisions in 1918. The Israelis did the same thing when they caught a large column of Egyptian armor and soldiers in a narrow pass during the 1967 Seven Days War. The World War II equivalents might be the destruction of Nazi tanks and troops in the killing grounds of the so-called Falaise Pocket in 1944, and aerial attacks by U.S. naval aircraft on convoys of Japanese troop ships. Life underneath the bombs has never been pleasant. Warning of imminent bombing attacks during World War II were signaled by horrendous sirens that many who experience their sound say chills their blood even now. Anything constructed underground was used for shelter by urban populations. Bomb shelters, prototypes of later backyard protections against nuclear attack, fortunately never yet tested, cluttered rural landscapes. The sirens were followed by the deafening drone of aircraft engines and firing of clustered anti-aircraft batteries, then the impact and explosions of thousands of bombs. Anyone above ground during the raids would see towering columns of smoke during the days, the glare of firestorms and searchlights at night. On March 9, 1945, more than 300 B-29 superfortresses attacked Tokyo, Max Boot wrote in his book, The Savage Wars of Peace, Small Wars, and the Rise of American Power. Their napalm and magnesium incendiaries turned 16 densely packed square miles into an inferno, Boot wrote. An estimated 84,000 people, mostly civilians, were killed, making this one of the deadliest days of warfare ever. Of the 50 or more million human beings who died in the Second World War, a considerable proportion died in bombing attacks. Hundreds of thousands were cremated or suffocated in their shelters. Untold numbers of families disappeared from history. Air Force General Ira Eaker complained in a foreword to a book about the bombing of Dresden, written by David Irving, yes, the same Irving who denied the Holocaust, that the men who died and shot down bombers are seldom considered in post-war books about the air war over Europe and Asia, though television documentaries are redundant in their portrayals of pilots and bomber crews. Most books concentrate on the massive death and destruction bombing raids caused, which is in contrast to books written during the war that justified bombing of civilian populations. Total warfare, after all, insists that all members of society either soldier or arm him or her. Tactical bombing seeks to destroy the soldier. Strategic bombing is more complex. Obliteration of production and supply is less a goal than erosion of morale, although several surveys indicate that bombings of civilians only increases their stoicism and antipathy toward their attackers, the anonymous flyers who indiscriminately murder friends, lovers, and children from the stratosphere. A U.S. bombing appraisal committee, which included John Kenneth Galbraith, concluded after World War II that bombing alone would never have sufficiently eroded determined resistance against attack by average German civilians. Galbraith personally thought, as survivors in Germany of Allied raids attested, that bombing actually developed a defiant camaraderie among those bombed on either side of the war. The immense air war of World War II can be scaled down to the minuscule. A family cowering in a shelter under a city ravaged by bombs dropped from fleets of airplanes, piloted by determined, frightened crews fighting off winged defenders whose rage and terror matched their enemy everywhere in the sky and on the ground, death and burning desolation. Only the Nazi death camps exceeded the horror of living underneath the bombs. The Germans initiated the slaughter with terror bombings of Guernica and Rotterdam and by their aerial war against England. A firestorm caused by incendiary bombs dropped by British aircraft on Hamburg in 1943 killed an estimated 100,000. The beautiful German city of Dresden was unnecessarily destroyed by bombers in 2 days and nights. Firebombing of Japan in 1945 incinerated several hundred thousand each raid on its cities by American B-29s. Atomic bombs dropped on Hiroshima and Nagasaki altered humanity's history and psyche. Michael S. Sherry wrote in his book, The Rise of American Air Power, The Creation of Armageddon, which was published by Yale Press, that, quote, the tension between large hopes and dark fears about the warplane said less about technology or erroneous predictions of air warfare than it did, quote, the cultures of which would build and use bombers. Although these apocalyptic apprehensions and dreams of deliverance, and that's a quote from Sherry, did not always explain why nations bombed one another, they at least suggest how they would justify bombing or why they sometimes needed little justification at all. And again, that is Sherry. The development of the bomber has resulted in the slaughter of millions who might not have died in warfare without its use. Michael Sherry wrote, to treat bombing simply as an abstraction, as a strategy or horrible fantasy or set of statistics, would be to repeat a persistent era in a half century's preoccupation with the bomber, the tendency to regard it, and finally the atomic bomb, as more potent in imagination than in its capacity to kill and destroy. Unquote. Perhaps the most inaccurate prediction about the age of the airplane was, as Sven Lindqvist wrote in A History of Bombing, the belief that, quote, flight would do away with the very cause of national conflicts by bringing people closer to one another. Those who had been divisive and hostile on the ground would live peacefully together in the boundless heavens during the age of flight. And that was Sven Lindqvist. And now, a poem by John Post, City Killer, Portrait of Death, A Tactical Target, The Blasted City, Footprints of Mars, 9 million Dead, $1 trillion Loss, Portrait of Abstract Beauty, Laser Carved, Rubble Structure, Crushed Cars on Asphalt, and That Mineral of Bones and Glass, Rock and Vaporized Steel, Hiroshimaite. Portrait of Political Process, The Top-Level Negotiators Drunk at the Whorehouse in Geneva. And that was City Killer by John Post. And now, as a Christmas conjuration, Possum in Terrace, Peace on Earth. Everybody wants it, though it is more a seasonal idea, traditional with Christmas bonhomme, not necessarily having much to do with the real world. The real world beats itself up every day, which includes Christmas. Christmas is among the very violent days of the year. Murders, suicides, drunken assaults upon family, friends, and strangers. Strangling a spouse with this year's lousy tie or latest zirconium necklace. Carving up the turkey sitting at the table next to the platter. Caroling groups mowed down by Uzi-armed Christopaths. Little girls and boys assaulted by merry old cherubs. Mommies baking poison pies and cookies. Daddies impaled on spiky plastic Christmas trees. Relatives gift-wrapping cluster bombs for the kiddies. Halloween nightmares crashing down midnight chimneys. Laughter, good cheer, and full bellies exude a gaseous odor of complacency that is unable to disguise despair, hunger, and murder shrieking from the outside frames of Grandma Moses' odes to family Christmas joy. So Merry Christmas. Peace on earth. Goodwill toward all everywhere. Perhaps the bonhomme and camaraderie of the season will shut out for a miracle moment the unholy howling of hellhounds. And in closing, I wish to pay tribute to Larry Heineman, a U.S. Army draftee Vietnam veteran who wrote one of the best novels of the war and its effect upon American veterans, Paco's Story, which won a National Book Award. He died December 11th at age 75. And to my aunt and godmother, Antonina Campesciani, Americanized to Combi, whose 104th birthday would have been tomorrow. She died in 2007 at age 91. And a birthday wish for a long life to Rosanna Spagnola, whose natal day is either today or Saturday. This is Michael McCusker. Happy Holy Days, and may all your Christmas wishes come true, especially about not becoming extinct in the near future through either nuclear immolation or climate incineration.